All right, we are beginning a new series today. As you can see at the top of your handout, the title of the series is God, My Exceeding Joy, A Joyful Journey Through the Psalms. I hope it'll be a joyful one. I suspect it'll be something of a long one, although I'm going to do my best. Should I even say that this? I'm going to do my best not for it to be that long. You know, I don't want to, well, anyway. I don't want it to last longer than the tribulation, and certainly not the millennium, but so this is a new series on the Psalms, and the title for this series comes from Psalm 43, verse 4, which you see printed there in the top of your handout. I will go to the altar of God, to God my exceeding joy, and upon the lyre I shall praise you, O God, my God. So this title and the verse it comes from reveals something of our complicated relationship with the Psalms. Now, maybe at first brush to you, that doesn't seem complicated, but think about this for a moment. Our hearts deeply resonate with this idea of calling God our exceeding joy. We're taught in through the gospel that we are to rejoice in the Lord always, and again I say rejoice. So our hearts resonate with that, but on the other hand, there are parts of that verse that don't apply to us in a direct way. We don't worship God at physical altars anymore. We don't have a temple. We don't have animal sacrifices. So here, packed into this little verse, is something that we can deeply resonate with, and then there's something that's kind of foreign to us. And this is a good example of what our relationship with the Psalms is like. Things that appeal to us very quickly, and other things that, if we think about it much, we kind of scratch our head at. So as we read the Psalms, number two, we find ourselves feeling both connected and disconnected from what we read. When we feel disconnected, what we're tempted to do, we're tempted to spiritualize the words to try to make it more relevant to us. You know, so we're tempted, for instance, when we read, I will go to the altar of God, we're tempted to turn that into when I go to church, or when I go to the Lord in prayer and my prayer goes to the heavenly temple. And that's maybe a little bit of a closer parallel, but you know, maybe there's some kind of application we can make that way, but it's not the same thing that David meant. What David meant was he was going to literally go to an altar where the tabernacle was and bring probably a thank offering to the Lord. So we're tempted when we find those parts that we don't naturally connect with, we're tempted to spiritualize them. And even when we do feel very well connected with the phrases that we read, we must try not to read in our own misunderstandings. Now, letter B in your handout directs you to the top of the page. There is a logo. If you look at the very top right of your handout, that logo, we're going to use that throughout this series. And this was a neat find for me. This is an old Israeli letterpress. So if you go on eBay and type in letterpress, there's all kinds of things for sale now because that old style of printing is basically, you know, they're not inking metal letterpresses and pressing the paper down on it. They're not doing it. It's all computerized print press now. So I don't know what print shop this came from in Israel, but that is a lyre. The symbol on the upper right of this page is that of a lyre. L-Y-R-E, not L-I-A-R.
Is that the Bible said that David played?
That's right, yes. So it's an ancient musical instrument. It's similar to a harp. Notice in that picture up at the top that what appears to be in the middle of it are the two tablets of the Ten Commandments. And if you count the lines in each of those little tablet-like things, there are five lines each. So it's a visual representation of the Ten Commandments. This reflects, now this is a Jewish publishing house that this came from, so I have this letterpress at home. And I've been, you know, it's not meant to be put on a stamp and then inked, but I'm cheating. That's how I'm doing this. And the fact that an Israeli publishing house would create a picture of a lyre with the Ten Commandments in it illustrates how deeply connected the Psalms are with the law of Moses. Not just the Ten Commandments themselves, but really all of the Torah, and how the Old Testament law defines many of the feelings and the expressions that we have in the Psalms. Now, I listed a few verses at the bottom of the page, passages, and many of these you don't even need to turn to, but Psalm 1, you know, begins, "Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord." The Torah, literally, the Torah of Yahweh. And how about Psalm 19? You know, it begins by talking about the glory of God in the heavens, but then in the middle of the psalm it switches, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul, restoring the soul," something like that. The law of the Torah of Yahweh. And of course, Psalm 119 is a great psalm about Torah. But not only those famous passages, but many others are deeply connected with the Torah. If a psalmist were to write a modern praise song, we might imagine him naming it, "I could sing of your law forever." There's a popular Christian praise chorus out right now called "I Could Sing of Your Love Forever." And it's a song that goes on and on and on. They keep saying, "I could sing of your love forever." Repeat that five times, or I don't know how many times. And so it's sort of like the song is doing what it's talking about. Well, I could imagine the psalmist saying something like, "I could sing of your law forever." In fact, Psalm 119 almost does that. 170-some verses about the law of God. And by law, what they mean in particular is the law of Moses. Usually, when we encounter those passages, we tend to expand the application to be all of the Bible. And there's some relevance in doing that. But when David and the other psalmists wrote about the law, they were thinking about the law of Moses. If you think about it now, in David's day, how much of the Bible did he have? He had the what we now call the five books of Moses. He had the law, maybe Joshua, maybe Judges, although Judges seems to be written in the days of the king, because remember it says again and again, there was no king in Israel in those days. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So that probably means that when the book was written, there was a king in Israel. So in David's day, there was the law of Moses, maybe Joshua, maybe Judges. Ruth is written during his day, because the last word in the book of Ruth is David, his genealogy. So he didn't have a whole Old Testament.
But when this Psalm of David was written, he was king of the Psalms.
Maybe. Now, he may have written some things before he was king, too. But
we don't know if he was king when he wrote this.
No, we don't know. In fact, I don't think he didn't write Psalm 119 itself, but yeah, we don't know. Okay, so this is the new series, God, My Exceeding Joy, and we talked about the logo. Let me outline for you, let her see what our course of study is going to be like, an overview of the course. Today, the second half of today's lesson is going to be how to interpret the Psalms. And this is a lesson that will bleed in the next week as well, how to interpret the Psalms. Before we begin to study each of the Psalms individually, we'll spend some time discussing which principles of Bible study that we've talked about over this last year are needed to best interpret these ancient songs. Throughout this story, we'll be able to use many of the principles of interpretation and application that we've discussed in the previous series on Read It Rightly, Read It Richly. So that's the first couple lessons are going to be interpreting principles for the Psalms. Secondly, we'll introduce the Psalms themselves. Introductory lessons that will cover topics like authorship and compilation. So this is a part of the Bible unlike any other part. This is a part of the Bible that grew in size over a period of 1,000 years. You have a Psalm 90 written by Moses. in the 1400s. Half of the Psalms say they're written by David, and that's around 1000 BC. And then you have a number of Psalms written in the days of, like, Ezra and Nehemiah, after the exile. So unlike any part of the Bible, this one spans a period of 1,000 years. And at some point, all of these different parts are compiled so that we end up with 150 in the order in which we find them. So the compilation, the ancient uses of the Psalms. Different Psalms are written and used for different reasons. The variety of the Psalms. And then we'll also talk about the final structure. You know, if you think about it, in David's day, the book of Psalms would have been shorter than what we have now, because there were people after his day who wrote Psalms as well. But we'll consider how, in the end, we end up with these five major sections. So we'll have a couple lessons on the Psalms as a whole. And then the third part of the course, the longest part of the course, will be a survey of each Psalm. And when I say survey, what I mean by that is most of the time it's not going to be a phrase-by-phrase exposition. This can be more of an overview of the particular passage. So the purpose of the course is to survey each psalm but not tackle every verse and every phrase thoroughly. Ideally, each lesson will cover at least one psalm, though some lessons might combine some together. Like Psalms 1 and 2 are very, very different psalms, but they also have some things that kind of bind them together. There seems to be a reason why they were placed where they were in that part of Israel's hymnal. Psalms 3, 4, 5, and 6 all have references either to morning or evening. In fact, Charles Spurgeon had a devotional book called Morning and Evening, and I think part of that idea was draws from those few psalms there. So there are some that will go together. And then there's some that are really long that might require more time. Many years ago, I preached a series on Psalm 119. It was only 6 months, but I don't plan to do that. It'll be more of an overview when we get to that one. All right, and then handouts for the course. Handouts, when we get to the survey of each psalm, handouts will contain visual outline charts for the hopefully forthcoming book, Visual Outline Charts of the Old Testament. So the second half of our study, I want to focus on some principles of interpretation. How to use what we've talked about for the last year, how to use the grammatical historical method for interpreting the Psalms. So today, let's talk about some of the grammatical side. Now, grammatical historical. So grammar is the analysis of the words and the phrases and the literature itself, whereas historical is the context of the writer, events that are going on, cultural things and customary things. So under the grammatical side, page 3, there's lots of things that fit under that that category. And the first thing we'll bring up is the French word genre. Genre. And in the Psalms, we find the genre of poetry. Poetry. Every psalm is a poem in the Hebrew text. And many of our modern versions will actually format the Psalms as English poetry, too. They'll break up the lines for you. Every psalm is an example of Hebrew poetry. Almost every line in every poem is in poetic form in the Hebrew Bible. The only exceptions to that are the little tiny headers that show up in 100 of the Psalms. We call them superscriptions, that is, they're writings that are above. So when it says, a Psalm of David, that's part of the original text. It's not been added by our publishers or printers. Now, most of our Bibles also add little descriptions. I've got mine open to Psalm 73, and it varies what version you have, but the publisher has said the end of the wicked contrasted with that of the righteous. That's not part of the original text. But the part right after it where it says a psalm of Asaph, that is part of the original part. Now, those little extras where they tell us who wrote it or what the song's for or what was happening in the event, those parts are not in poetry. Those parts are the only pieces of the Psalms that are not in poetic form. Okay, every psalm is a poem. Also, every poem is a song. This is something we often miss out on. We don't sing the psalms very much. Usually, if we do, it's just pieces of them that have been put into praise songs or hymns. But each of these poems was originally set to music. Now, the music for the psalms was not inspired, and it has not been preserved. We don't have any examples of ancient Israelite music. We do have a couple ancient examples of pagan music that date to Bible times. Maybe in one of the future lessons I'll play an example of that. It uses 8-note scales, and it's a little bit different. But the music itself was not inspired. It was not written down along with the words. The Spirit inspired the words, not the notes. And that would give Israel liberty over the years to write different music as it might need to. So every psalm is a poem. Every psalm is a song. Every poem had a purpose. Every poem, every psalm had a purpose. There were different reasons why and ways that a psalm might be used. And I've listed out for you 7 different kinds of psalms. And you maybe could come up with others, but I think I've seen lists up to 12. But the majority of them would fit under this. Let's consider number 1, spiritual instruction. Some psalms are written as a teacher to students. And that's exactly what you have in Psalm 1. How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, stand in the path of sinners, sit in the seat of scoffers. His delight is in the law of the Lord, and he shall be like a tree. And so it's this description of a righteous man. And the idea is that you, as the worshiper, as a listener, would think, that's what I want to be like. So there are psalms of instruction. You even have little phrases sometimes where David will say, listen to me, my children, and I shall teach you the fear of the Lord. Instructive psalms. And so, you know, Paul says in, is it Ephesians or Colossians, that you're to teach one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. There are certain psalms in particular that are meant to be instructive. Well, another kind of psalm is what we call public thanks. Flip with me to Psalm 9, and you'll see an example of that. Public thanks. The word public is important, because usually in the Psalms, when someone gives thanksgiving, it's not just me quietly in my heart saying a silent prayer. It's me taking a sacrifice to the tabernacle to make an offering and tell everyone what the Lord did. So we won't read all of Psalm 9, but just a part of it. You'll see how here David gives thanks for something great that the Lord has done. Notice that there's a superscription, a little title up there, for the choir director, on Muth Lav Ben, a psalm of David. I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonders. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turn back, they stumble and perish before you. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne judging righteously. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy has come to an end in perpetual ruins, and you have uprooted the cities. The very memory of them has perished. As you can guess from this psalm, David is giving thanks for victory in war, that the Lord has put down his enemies and shown him favor. So this psalm will recount a lot of what the Lord did in this case. It's a psalm of public thanks. Okay, number 3, another kind of psalm is painful lamenting. Laments. We have laments in our contemporary world. There are a lot of country western songs are laments. In fact, there's one called The Lament of the Cowboy, you know, and all these horrible things have happened to me, and the music is kind of... All right, okay. So here, look at Psalm 10, and I've put these in order of our way through the Psalms, so we don't have to flip around too much. Psalm 10, why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? In pride, the wicked hotly pursue the afflicted. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. So this, right, look at verse 12 also. Arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the afflicted. Why has the wicked spurned God? He has said to himself, you will not require it. So this psalm includes a lot of lament. In fact, it's been said that the majority, and when I say majority, I mean like a simple majority, the majority of the psalms are psalms of lament. The name, and this isn't in your notes, but the name that we use to this for this book comes from the Greek title. And the Hebrew calls it something else. And the Greek title come up with between the time of the Testament, Psalms, means plucking of the harp. Pluckings of the harp. That's what Psalms mean. And the Hebrew title for Tehillim means praises. But the irony is that more of the Psalms are Psalms of lament and complaint and Lord help, don't you see what's happening? Oh, painful lamenting. We'll find many Psalms. And sometimes there'll just be a little part of the Psalm that will have this. Another kind of Psalm is personal confession. There are a number of these. Maybe some have said up to half a dozen. The two most famous ones are this one that I've listed for you, Psalm 51. Another one is Psalm 32. But Psalm 51 actually has a header that explains to us the background. For the choir director, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came to him after he had gone into Bathsheba. Be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness. According to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Psalms of personal confession. Another very common form of psalm, especially the further you go into the Psalms, you find more of these, public praise, where the whole course of people, whole nation of people are commanded to come before the Lord. So Psalm 100, the command there, shout joyfully to the Lord, all the earth. The word shout is plural. All y'all shout. In fact, every one of the verbs in Psalm 100 is plural. You all shout joyfully. You all serve the Lord with gladness. You all come before him with joyful singing. You all know that the Lord himself is God. Verse 4, you all enter his gates with thanksgiving and his courts with praise. Give thanks to him, bless his name, for the Lord is good. His loving kindness is everlasting, his faithfulness to all generations. Public praise is a common kind of psalm. And then there are some, and there's a debate as to how many exactly, but there are some that are messianic prophecies. Psalm 110 is perhaps the clearest of them all. Psalm 110, and I say it's the clearest because Jesus actually says that this is not about David, it's about him. Psalm 110, we're told it's by David, a psalm of David. The Lord says to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. So this is David speaking, and he said, Yahweh said to my master, which is a curious phrase for a king to say. He has some master over him that's different from Yahweh. And this is the New Testament. This verse, you've heard me say before, is the one verse in the Old Testament that is quoted the most in the New Testament. Many, many times quoted it, and almost always it's applied directly to Jesus. If not to Jesus, it's applied to the followers of Jesus who share in his victory. So there are psalms of messianic prophecy. A lot of times these psalms really don't have anything to do with us. And, you know, sometimes the tendency is to try to read them and find myself in the psalm, and when really it's not about us, it's about the one to come. Yes?
Psalm 10, if I may for a minute. Lamenting, is that by any chance similar to the lamenting in Jeremiah?
Yes, that's right. The book of
Jeremiah?
Yeah. In that case, there's a, Lamentations is five chapters of just pouring his heart out to God. And actually, Jeremiah does that. It's not just for himself. He's doing that So to give structure to the grief of the people of Jerusalem, they've lost everything. Temple's gone, priesthood's gone, everything's gone. So it's like he gives them a little miniature hymnal to use in the short term. And it gives structure. You know, four of those chapters are acrostics. So the first verse begins with Aleph, and the second verse begins with Beth, and the third verse begins with Gimel. Or the first three are with Aleph, the next three are with Beth. And it's a systematic way of processing your grief in a way. There's limits to it. There's a sort of a structure to grieving. Laments sometimes have this purpose of kind of giving voice to your grief and also giving some boundaries to it. And then the last category that I've listed here for you is prayerful pleading. Psalm 140 is an example of this. And this sort of crosses over with laments. Usually, if someone's lamenting, they're going to turn to pleading very soon. But in Psalm 140, for the choir director, a psalm of David, "Rescue me, O Lord, from evil men. Preserve me from violent men who devise evil things in their hearts. They continually stir up wars. They sharpen their tongues as a serpent. Poison of a viper is under their lips." Selah. So there are some psalms that are very heavy with this kind of prayer. And we tend to gravitate towards these in our times of distress. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the lesson, we kind of have mixed feelings when we read some of them. We feel connected because we're going through a time of distress and difficulty and we're crying out to God. But then we feel disconnected when we read these references to warfare or the altar or prayers for utter destruction of our enemies, which we try to figure out how does that fit in with me as a follower of Jesus. And so those are some issues we'll discuss as we go through this series. So the first bit of grammatical analysis to bear in mind when we encounter the Psalms is genre, and particularly that they are, every one of the Psalms is a poem, and there are many different kinds of poems, and bearing that in mind will help us. And I didn't mention it here, but I'm sure I will have lessons to come, that a lot of the Psalms are actually a mixture of different kinds of poems. Not so much that they're different poems stitched together, but different sorts of poetry are put together. Like in Psalm 19, we start off, "The heavens declare the glory of God." And then we move on to talk about the law of the Lord is perfect. And then it ends with a prayer. A prayer that the Lord would keep David, that the Lord would keep him from sin. It almost becomes like a confession at the end. So there's two or maybe three different kinds of poetry in that one psalm. All right, another grammatical feature, every psalm has poetic features. Poetic features, and I mean by this more than just that it's poetry, but there are certain poetic features, and I'm going to list just a couple today, and then we'll pick up with it more next time. Here are some of the more common features of Hebrew poetry. Frequent use of imagery. Frequent use of imagery, more so than what you use when you're telling a story. Now, in different parts of our country, when you tell stories, you might use a lot of pictures. Oh, he was like a coon dog chasing after, you know, you might do that. But generally speaking, poetry has a lot more imagery in it than just storytelling does, or certainly more than law does. Symbolism is a nearly universal feature of poetry around the world. In almost any part of the world, when you find peoples that have poetry, there's going to be a lot more imagery in it. The Psalms are really rich in this. I mean, think about the first Psalm. "He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings its fruit in its season. Its leaf doesn't wither. Whatever he does prospers. The wicked are not so. They're like chaff, which the wind drives away." Psalm 2 has, "He shall break them with a rod of iron. He shall break them like pieces of pottery." Psalm 3, "You are my shield, O God." And I could go through almost every psalm. There are, I didn't find one in Psalm 4, so that's why I stopped. But, of course, Psalm 23, "The Lord is my shepherd." I mean, very, very vivid imagery. Okay, and imagery requires us to, usually to us, the idea behind the image is clear, but occasionally they it talks about things that aren't customary. Their throat is an open grave, for instance, the psalm says. An open grave. Now, we don't encounter that very much. But in the ancient days, they would encounter graves much more. You know, we've sort of sanitized death and have cemeteries set apart, and we almost never go to them. But in the ancient world, you're coming across tombs all the time, and to find an open one is just, why would you leave that open? It's just, you know, because the body is there, visible and smellable. So sometimes we have to jump into that culture and that setting to appreciate the imagery. That's where historical study helps us. Okay, another poetic feature, imagery is one. Another is parallel lines of thought. Parallel lines of thought. And I know we talked about this in our study of hermeneutics, but I want us to meditate on it a little bit more. We go to our last page. Many lines of Hebrew poetry use something called parallelism. Parallelism. And in parallelism, generally what happens is the first line of the verse is echoed. It's echoed in one way or another by the next line. And there's different ways it can be echoed. I've given four here. I've seen upwards of seven different kinds. This is a very, very common part of Hebrew poetry. It's not true that every verse of poetry does it. I'd say, if I had to estimate, I'd say probably 70% of verses in the Psalms do it in one way or another. But there are some that don't. Okay, the most common kind is what we call synonymous parallelism. That is where you've got one line of poetry followed by a second line that essentially says the same thing, but with slightly different words. A great example of this is Psalm 1, verse 2. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. That's roughly the same idea. It's an echo. There's a little more information in the second line, but it's essentially the same thought, just packaged. It's like the ribbon coming around the idea twice.
Do you suppose that's a teaching tool?
Perhaps. I mean, definitely in the Proverbs. The Proverbs do this a lot also, have this kind of parallelism. In English poetry, in Western poetry, one of the dominant features in Western poetry is sound rhyme. Jack and Jill went up a hill to fetch a pail of water. And meter, too, but sound rhyme. All of our hymns do it. Every hymn we sing today will have rhyme like that. In the Semitic world, not just Israel, but in the other nations around it, poetry tends to have more what we call thought rhyme, where whole lines are echoed by a similar idea. It's a different way of thinking about poetry. But I would imagine, yes, it does have a instructive benefit,
too. If you didn't get the point in the first half of the sentence, then when it repeats,
yes,
you'll catch the second one. But even in the New Testament, you have examples of
you do have that. And if you think about it, almost all of the New Testament writers are Hebrews. Maybe, Luke might be the only exception. So the Greek of the New Testament is said to be Semitic Greek, that it's influenced by Hebrew forms of expression. So later on, we'll come back to this kind and show how the second line does more than just echo the first line. It actually clarifies the first line. It narrows our understanding down. Okay, another very common kind of parallelism is contrasting parallelism. Now, this spot's not in your notes. The fancy $50 word for that is antithetical. Antithetical parallelism is what you'll find in the textbooks, but I used contrasting because that's the same idea. The second line says the opposite of the first line, but it's not doing that as a contradiction. It's not saying, well, God says this sometimes, and other times he says something else. It's not like the verse is at odds with itself. It's by way of a contrast. So, you know, in the first psalm, the psalm ends, the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So there's some kind of a contrast that's being set up between the righteous and the wicked, particularly between their ends. And again, the second half of it sharpens your understanding of the first half. Whatever the Lord knowing the way of the righteous means, it's the opposite of the destruction of the wicked's way. And that suggests the Lord knows the way of the righteous because he's with them, he's leading them, he's taking them to his destination, as opposed to the way of the wicked leads to destruction away from him. So that's contrasting parallel. A lot of the Proverbs, which aren't Psalms, but they're poetry, many of the Proverbs are contrasting parallelism. Another kind of parallelism, we'll call it picture parallelism, or the $50 word. There's no spot for this in your notes, but emblematic is what the textbooks call this. Emblematic parallelism is where the first line has some sort of comparison, comparative picture, and then the second line applies it. A great example of that is Psalm 42, verse 1. Psalm 42. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so my soul pants for you. Word picture in the first half of the verse, explanation, application of the picture in the second half. Maybe I think of, you know, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. It's not exactly the same because it's not the Lord is like my shepherd, but there's something like that. The second line explains the relevance of the picture in the first half. And then this is, number four is an interesting one, climax parallelism. Climax, where the first line is followed by several more lines within the same verse or the next verse that repeat the same words with some variation until finally erupting in a statement that brings it to resolution. Psalm 29, the first two verses are a great example of this climactic or climax parallelism. So Psalm 29, verse 1, ascribe to the Lord, O sons of the mighty. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. Worship the Lord in holy array. Ascribe, ascribe, ascribe. And the first time, there's actually no direct object. Ascribe to the Lord, sons of the mighty. What am I supposed to ascribe? And so it makes you go through to ascribe to the Lord glory and strength, and then ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name. So repetition, kind of building, the length of the lines is growing each time, and then finally you get to the last line, worship the Lord in holy array. It's sort of like a final eruption in the poetic lines. So the important thing in knowing about these different sorts of things is that each related line helps to interpret the first line. Seldom does a psalmic verse have two unrelated ideas. So I see this happen a lot where there'll be a verse with two lines and someone will explain the first line one way and then the second line another way, and they don't really relate to each other. But the way these work is the second line sharpens or clarifies the first one. It's sort of a narrowing effect. Let's look at one example this morning in Psalm 19, verse 1. You can turn there. You might well already know it by heart. Psalm 19:1 is an example of synonymous parallelism, two lines that are in essence saying the same thing. The heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse is declaring the work of his hands. Heavens are telling of the glory of God, and their expanse, or the firmament, is declaring the work of his hands. Okay. Now, when we first read that phrase, the glory of God, we might have, if the verse stopped right there, we might have all kinds of questions. What exactly does he mean by the glory of God? as I go through the Old Testament, I see a lot of different ways that God's glory is talked about. Could it refer to the Shekinah glory of God? That is the great outburst of light from God's very presence. Shekinah is a word that's not actually used in the Hebrew Bible. The Jews later used it. It means the presence. Now you do see the presence in the stories, like when the glory of God comes and fills the tabernacle, fills the temple. But okay, so the phrase "the glory of God" that could mean the Shekinah all by itself. It could mean that. But let's ask ourselves: do we see that in the heavens? Is there any spot I can gaze up and say, "Up, oh, there's the Shekinah"? No, not really. And what helps to clarify is the second line. The second line of the poem funnels down my thinking to focus on what aspect of God's glory is it that's being revealed in the heavens. The second line parallels this thought with the reference to the works of his hands. So whatever the glory of God is, it's paralleled with the works of his hands. So that narrows our understanding. In other words, God's greatness is apparent to those who look in the heavens that he has created. But looking into the sky does not reveal the Shekinah of God's glory. So it's the sun and the moon and the stars, and with the thought that, someone greater than these things has made them. That is the glory of God. So God's glory here is not something visible. It's not the visible glory of God, but it's something conceptual that people are conceiving of God as glorious and powerful and great. So this is, I think, a great example of how the second line helps you to interpret the first one. It narrows down the field of understanding. So as you go through any of the Psalms, when there is parallelism, be mindful of this tool. It's a useful thing. It's a good rule of context, actually, that these lines are bound together. They're meant to be interpreted together. So when we come back next week, we'll talk about some other features, poetic features, that we have to bear in mind when we interpret the Psalms. And some other grammatical issues, and we'll talk about historical issues too. So I think next week we'll finish up most of the how to study the Psalms, and then again we'll get into the studying the Psalms as a whole, you know, how this marvelous book came to be written, and then we'll start to plot through them one by one. All right, let's have prayer together, shall we, and ask the Lord to bless to us what we've studied. Our gracious, glorious God, we thank you that you have revealed yourself not only in the heavens, and we learn from them that you are grand and powerful and great, but you've revealed yourself especially to us in your word. And we thank you for this rich part of your word, these 150 poems that speak today very powerfully to our hearts. Help us as we study them that we might know you and love you and pray to you aright, that we might understand our place in your plan and enjoy the new songs that you give to your people today. In Christ's name, we pray these things.
Amen.
Amen.